Jana Varcher commented that I've done quite a number of these rambles now. I'm not sure how many it is. And it's a format that I personally really like. And I like the metaphor of ramble. I don't know what it communicates to all of you, but when I talk about a ramble, it connotes, well, first of all, a journey which is slightly aimless, in which one sets out without any very clear idea about where one is going, and which is also a bit leisurely. And yes, you don't quite know where you're going to go or what you're going to find. And that's very much the spirit in which I set out on these, and I imagine it's even more the case for you, because you've no idea what I'm going to talk about. To be frank, I've not a very great deal of idea what I'm going to talk about. But yes, the ramble format has the danger that you won't go anywhere at all and just get slightly lost. And I think once or twice on previous rambles we have got involved with rather a lot of blackberry bushes and even some quagmires. But it also has the advantage, this sort of format, that well, the unexpected can arise, and things that I certainly didn't mean to say, some of which I regret later, may emerge. And sometimes, sort of between us, something quite fresh and new and unexpected may arise. So I find the metaphor of ramble a very useful one. I prefer it infinitely to giving a talk, which I have to think about in advance and prepare and get it right. It's quite interesting because I suppose I've got a particular direction I want to ramble in, and it's in the direction of well, imagination. And of course, in talking about rambling, I've been evoking an image of a ramble, a walk in the country of a particular kind, and I can imagine that as I was talking, the image itself communicated something to you. Probably different things for different people, but you'll have got some idea of what the image was getting at and what I meant. Which, if I just told you, I'm going to talk without quite knowing what I'm going to talk about and see what happens, wouldn't have quite communicated the same flavour. There's a sort of a playfulness, an air of slight excitement or interest or openness to the unexpected that the very word ramble gives. So yes, in using that, I'm evoking imagination. And so what I want to talk about is the significance of imagination for the Dhamma life, the place of imagination in Dhamma life. I'm not going to define it exactly because, well, in a way, that the whole theme of imagination defies definition. We're walking into an area of human experience which passes beyond the merely rational, beyond what can be easily confined to a set of concepts or a set of definitions. So I'm going to talk about it and hope that in talking about it I will be able to evoke for you the imagination and its place in the Dhamma life. Because I believe it's a very, very important place that it has in Dhamma life. And I believe it's a very, very important theme for us as Buddhists coming from different cultures. Cultures outside the old Buddhist world, and cultures within which Buddhism has not traditionally been present. So we're needing to reimagine the Buddha, we're needing to reimagine Buddhism within the cultures from which we come, because we come from a number of different cultures. We share a culture which is multicultural, in which we have many, many influences upon us coming from many different sources. And within that, most of us at least are needing to rediscover, reimagine Buddhism, reimagine the Buddha. We're needing to discover what the Buddha looks like to us now from our particular cultures and our shared common culture, which has been influenced by a massive change in outlook, the whole scientific revolution, the whole rational revolution has affected us very, very radically. It's affecting the old Buddhist world as well. So we're having to rediscover, reimagine what the Buddha looks like, to use that metaphor. So, yes, I want to explore with you what imagination is and how we, I was going to say use it in spiritual life, it's more like how it uses us in spiritual life. And hopefully we'll discover something a bit new, something useful. The ramble format is definitely one in which I'm striding out ahead. But I'm quite happy to be arrested in the sense that if there's something that I say that is mystifying, puzzling, I hope there's something I say that's mystifying and puzzling, because I wouldn't like it all to be too clear if we're dealing with imagination. So if I say something that sort of evokes questions for you, then please interrupt. If you'll give me the license, I may say, shut up. No, I wouldn't say that. But I may say, can you hold that? Because I'm going somewhere which I think would be interesting. But I'll try and come back to you. It's a little bit difficult because there's so many people, and it can get a bit tiresome for others if the overall direction is lost, because there are too many directions being posted. So I'll keep up the group leader's role if I can, if I can get a word in edgeways. But in a way, I welcome some provocation from the floor. I'm saying that right now. I don't know what I'll feel like later. And I do carry a bit of a stick, you know, to lean on, of course. So, yes, let me start off then by talking a little bit about what I mean exactly, but the kind of things that imagination means, at least for me. I'm drawing on the teachings of Sangharakshita, of the founder and principal teacher of our order. I've had recently a series of conversations with him on the theme of imagination, because I believe that it's a key element in his teaching, which is extremely important for the unfolding of the Buddhist life in the modern world, especially outside its old heartlands in the Buddhist East. So I'm drawing on that material. He himself draws a lot on the material coming from, but principally the English aesthetic critical tradition, particularly going back to the English Romantics, but going way back beyond that as well, even back into the Greeks. But of course, what he has to say isn't just about, it's not just a literary critical theory. It's drawing on that to evoke something about who we are that is very, very important. So first of all, I'm using the terminology of imagination. Of course, I do not mean mere imagination. You know, as one says to somebody, oh, that's your imagination. In other words, it's something artificial that you've fantasized. It's what the English poet and critic Coleridge called fancy. fancy for him meant the mere rearrangement of elements of our experience to form a new combination in the sense of a combination that had not happened before, but that expressed nothing new, an artificial putting together of images in a way that is perhaps new, but that doesn't actually communicate anything particularly important or significant or new. I'll give you an example that came to me recently. I was listening to some Bach, which I do from time to time, some cantatas of Bach, and I had the misfortune to watch them on a DVD which had a translation of the German into English. And I was really enjoying the music, and then I noticed the words, and the words were, "Let me bathe myself in your blood and rest in your wounds as upon a rock." I'm afraid I didn't really enjoy the music after that. It's such a ghastly and artificial image, if you see what I mean. It doesn't really evoke anything apart from a rather unpleasant sort of mental image. It doesn't evoke anything of a real imaginative nature, poetic nature. So it's an artificial construction. It's a pietist, a theologian, trying to set music, having the greatest composer there's ever been, in my humble opinion, and giving in the most dreadful words. He made the most beautiful music out of it, but the words are so artificial, the image is so constructed, that it just kills the music. So imagination is not this fancy. It's not just a mistaken notion about things. It's not just an artificial putting together of images. It's something that we'll slowly discover is of a creative kind. The second thing I should say by way of introduction is that imagination isn't merely to do with the visual sense. It doesn't in its root meaning imply that, but so often when we say use your imagination, you sort of tend to close your eyes and see something, or try to see something. But imagination operates through all the ordinary senses, the five physical senses. It also operates through the kinesthetic sense, the locational sense. You can imagine somebody in front of you without seeing them. I mean, in a way, you do that when you're on the phone, don't you? You're on the phone and you're talking to somebody over the phone, and you actually sense them there in front of you. So that that you may not actually have a picture of them, but you've got a sort of sense of their presence. So imagination is can include these rather indefinable elements of sensing. So yes, when I'm talking about imagination, I probably will tend often to slip into talking about it as vision, because that's the readiest exemplification of it. You know, like the image of resting in your blood or whatever it is. It's all rather visual, isn't it? Or you could sort of... No, we won't go there. Please don't sort of allow... If it works for you, if you do, when I say imagine, if the visual sense is the one that it conjures up for you, that's fine. But a lot of people don't easily envision, if you see what I mean. You know, for instance, if you're invited in meditation to do some sort of visualization, a lot of people don't actually see anything, certainly not to begin with. So you can be asked to visualize the Buddha, but many people wouldn't actually see the Buddha, but you'd feel him to be there, perhaps, or maybe you'd have some sort of almost like a location in your body, a sense in your body, which corresponded to the Buddha being there. So when we're talking imagination, we're not talking merely the visual sense. We're talking about the five sense faculties and other faculties that are more indefinable, less easy to put your finger on. And even faculties that really do radically transcend our ordinary experience. So yes, imagination. It's first of all to be considered in this reading of it as a faculty that we have, a capacity that we have. We have the capacity to imagine, and we all do it. The probably the most obvious example that we have is in dreaming. Although maybe you can't remember your dreams, some people find it hard to remember. Probably everybody knows that they do dream. So in dreaming, sometimes at least, imagination does come into play. So you could say that a lot of dreaming is sort of card indexing. You're just organising the data of your experience into some sort of peaceful hole or uncomfortable hole sometimes. You're just dealing with stored up experience. But sometimes when you dream, probably everybody will have had this experience, you touch on something that is a bit electrifying. So that when you wake up, even if you can't exactly remember what you dreamt, you know that something significant happened. You're left at least with a feeling or with an image that for you means something, although you may not be able to say what it means. So dreaming is probably the sort of clearest example that we have of imagination at work. So I'm saying that not all dreaming is imagination in this richer sense that I'm trying to give it. Some of our dreaming is merely fancying in the Coleridgean sense, or fantasy. It's just reorganising things, sorting them out, settling them down. But some of it, you feel something important has happened. Maybe disturbing. Yes, sometimes you wake up with a dream and you don't know what to do with it, but you want to stay with it and you want to somehow value it. So usually what you do is you tell somebody over breakfast when they're not quite awake and haven't had their coffee yet and would really rather you didn't. Or they just quickly want to tell you their dream. The impulse that seeks to communicate the dream comes from its charge. Something has been struck that is significant. And it can be very, very powerful indeed. In fact, in Buddhist tradition, it's said that you can gain enlightenment in a dream. You may touch upon the way things really are in the dream state. I personally think that we ought to do a lot more dream classes, and we all ought to, at the beginning of the session, I ought to have said, now please lie down, turn over on your right side and go to sleep. But unfortunately, I wouldn't know what to do with you then. dreaming is a very, very important aspect of our lives, which I think we need to take much more seriously. And it can be a very powerful arena for the expression of imagination as this faculty that we all have that goes beyond our ordinary experience, that strikes at meaning, that strikes at depths beyond our ordinary reality. But imagination comes into play in a number of other areas of our lives. Of course, we're very familiar with it in the field of our cultural experience. A lot of our musical experience or watching films and so forth, actually it's much more to do with fantasy or fancy. It's just sort of occupying yourself, entertaining yourself in perhaps interesting ways, but it doesn't sort of strike at anything deeper. But from time to time, our cultural experience, and I don't mean by that necessarily just Bach and Shakespeare, as it were, It can be in quite unexpected areas, in popular music, even popular cinema. Sometimes depths are touched, which electrify, and where something happens within you, is struck within you, that you often can't explain. You can't in a way even do anything with, but something has happened to you from that cultural experience. So you hear a piece of music, and suddenly you're attending fully, and you sense, you feel that you're in contact with a meaning that has no words, a recognition of something that you can't heave into your mouth, but that seems deeply important. I think cinema is probably the popular medium that has most people have some experience of, and in quite unexpected areas of cinema, you find yourself suddenly electrified or awakened, and much, much sharper, much clearer than you were before. Maybe in popular music, maybe in classical music. No, it's not necessarily confined to the genre, if you see what I mean. I always think that genre, say, in film, is a red herring. That people say, I like sci-fi. I think actually, I don't like sci-fi. What I like is good film. And, sci-fi by Tarkovsky is utterly different from by somebody else, if you see what I mean. So it's not a question of the genre, it's a question of the sensibility of the director, and the power of the actors to communicate something more. So yes, it's a faculty that we have that operates within us, but of which we're often... we're not unaware of its effects, but we're not often aware of its significance, its importance, and its possibility. I think this is especially the case in our more recent culture. Although there are areas of our culture that value imagination, as this faculty that pushes a little beyond our normal experience, it's not something that's sort of talked about, not something that's recognised, not something that's valued. The Romantics in the late 18th, early 19th century began to emphasise imagination because they felt it was being lost. They sensed that something vital to what it was to be a human being was gradually being eroded. So you get William Blake and his Dark Satanic Mills, which is a sort of prefiguration of the mobile phone. I think the mobile phone is the modern Dark Satanic Mill. I'm sorry, I've got a real thing about mobile phones. I keep the oldest phone I've ever... Look, you're going into the past. That's what I call a mobile phone. It's something you can hit somebody with. Anyway, that... sorry, I can't stop myself when this comes up. Yes?
I have a question. Hmm. You seem to be talking about what I call inspiration rather than imagination.
Hmm.
What I would call imagination is what you would term as fantasy. Hmm. But in a sense, there's what I call pre-rational instinct,
mm-hmm.
and then there's trans-rational inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Most scientists, if they're working on a problem, actually rely on trans-rational inspiration.
So can I ask, that if you see what I mean, you've got your angle of approach, and it sounds a very interesting one, but for me to really engage with that, I've got to switch off what I'm doing.
If you can
ask me a question, I can do something with it. But it's more difficult when you're giving me a theory, if you see what I mean.
Well, yeah. I was trying to say that, in a sense, how do you fit what you're saying into the into a sense of Buddhist theory of mind.
Huh.
Because, say, in Tamatra, for instance, there's different levels of consciousness, for instance.
Right.
The state fits yeah. into that. And you have dreams of clarity,
yeah.
which usually arrive.
Yeah.
Usually
I think I just have to say, watch this space. Okay. I'm only just setting out okay. on my journey. I hope this doesn't sound rude, if you see what I mean, because I've invited questions and now I'm telling you to pipe down. But do you see what I mean? I need a little bit more space to unfold what I'm getting at, and then maybe it'll become clear, or maybe you'll say, yes, but you didn't actually get there. Yeah. So if you could hold that one. So, yes, I'm going to worm my way into it rather than define my way into it. So we've got imagination as a faculty, something that we have, that we experience in from time to time in our ordinary lives, that's not mere fancy. But talking of it as a faculty, yes, it implies it's something we need to discover, we need to recognise that we've got, and we need to bring into play much more fully. We need to value the faculty of imagination. But I hope this will come out later, and it may start to relate to what you're talking about. As we identify the faculty of imagination more fully, and we begin to experience it operating more and more fully, we begin to recognise it's not merely a part of us, but it's actually what we are. This faculty, as our discussion goes on, I hope you'll understand what I mean, it's actually what we are. So that when we get into meditation, when we get into dhyana, what we're experiencing is the faculty of imagination. It's that faculty operating now fully, as it were, integrated, rather than as a part of what we are. So we've got imagination as different from fancy or fantasy. We've got imagination as a faculty. As a faculty that we do experience. We experienced in the significant dreams that we have, in our significant cultural experience, aesthetic experience, but we experience increasingly as our minds as a whole in dhyana, in meditation. But there's another very important characteristic of imagination. When you have imaginative experience, it has a flavour of something more than you. Imagination doesn't strike you as yours, or is only partly yours. So, you know, often the context in which we often talk of imagination is in the context of artistic creation, and in the act of artistic creation, when it is genuinely imaginative, there's a sense that something's happening that is not yours. You are not doing. So that the poem writes itself. As you paint, something is happening, that your paintbrush is being guided, not by your will, not by your volition. And it's a very common experience for those who create, that something is happening that's more than you. In meditation, the experience, as you really begin to meditate, is that something is happening that's from beyond your conscious identity. It's not you, exactly. It's not somebody else. Although sometimes it may present itself to you as somebody else, or some sort of imaginative figure, your muse, or some god, or whatever. But there's a flavour of something that transcends your conscious identity. Imagination has that character. So the The dreams that are, I would say, truly imaginative seem to come from beyond you. They don't seem to be just about you. The aesthetic experience that you have that is really imaginative seems to come from something beyond you. I was just the other day, for curious reasons, I was revisiting my own past. I remember when I was at college in London here, I went to a concert by the Pink Floyd at the Roundhouse. Anybody remember the Pink Floyd? In their early days with Sid Barrett. It was called Psychedelica Mania versus Ian Smith. You can locate it politically thereby. I went into this concert, and you know, I like the Rolling Stones and all that, and I was quite into blues. This was full psychedelic rock, and there were, you know, the light show. I'd never even heard of a light show. And it was the Roundhouse, which at that time was just an engine shed which some hippies had got hold of and made into a venue. Probably health and safety didn't exist in those days. It's been invented since with the mobile phone. But the dark satanic mills and me. There were aspects of the early Pink Floyd, I think they went wrong later, there are aspects of the early Pink Floyd that I think really did have something of imagination. I don't think it's of, you know, abiding historical significance, but it certainly did evoke something that went quite beyond anything that I'd ever been struck before. You were there, Mangala. And without any drugs, I hadn't even heard of drugs then, and so forth. I was just in a totally different state of mind, and the sense that I got, and I do think it was Sid Barrett in particular who communicated it, and it did have a pretty weird edge to it, of course, as later events proved. The poor fellow had a breakdown. But there was something about that concert that was really one of the first experiences for me of a little bit of imagination, something that was really very much beyond my ordinary experience. And in a way, it's why I'm here. I touched in that music. And not just the music, the whole ambience and the imaginative richness that they evoked, something that was definitely beyond me. I felt possessed in a very positive sense, although a rather disturbed sense. I felt possessed by something that was more than me. Unfortunately, it led me down a wrong avenue for a while, because it led me into a little bit of drugs and all that. Although that was not unuseful. Oops, sorry. In a way, I was exploring imagination even through that, although I don't think it's the way to do it. So, yes, you get this sense that something has taken you over, something has come in, something has touched you that's more than you, and it can come in all sorts of ways. But I've deliberately evoked something from, as it were, popular culture, albeit fringe, because I don't want to place this too high. I mean, I think that the greatest of these experiences, the most powerful and the most valuable, come from the greatest minds, the greatest creators. But it goes on all sorts of levels, in all sorts of fields. And I think there is, even in Hollywood, there can be an imaginative depth struck. So you shouldn't get snooty about it all. So all sorts of experiences that put you into a state of consciousness that we would call somewhat higher, which has this flavour of being out of yourself, beyond yourself, in contact with something more than yourself. So this is a very, very important aspect of imagination. It has something of something more than you. From a Buddhist point of view, this is pretty straightforward. You are contacting dimensions of the mind that go at least a little bit beyond the ordinary conscious identity. In these sort of experiences, you are passing into the realms of archetype, the realms of if you're lucky, into something that's of a higher nature or of a more deeply primal nature, that is definitely beyond individual, and which hopefully is being brought into your conscious experience, and if you can, if you're able, integrated. But you're having an experience of something far bigger than you. This is the nature of imagination. It can be that imagination is what Sangharakshita calls illumined. This very powerful sense of something beyond you may be illumined by the true nature of things. It may be that imaginative experience contains insight. It may be that the image is transformed by insight. So the image may transform itself. In classical Buddhism, in classical Mahayana Buddhism, you deliberately work with this experience. And I'll talk more about this probably the day after tomorrow. You deliberately work with this sort of field. You deliberately work with images which initially are somewhat beyond you. You work particularly with images of the Buddha. You contemplate those images, and you hope that those images will come alive for you. They become invested with imaginative significance. To begin with, you do it as an exercise. But as you contemplate them, something of imagination enters into them, and they become invested with power, with significance. You have a sense that the image is beginning to live a bit beyond you. It's still mundane. It's not, in a sense, the Buddha. It's an image of the Buddha, but it's not the Buddha. So initially, you contemplate that image. You put up the image in front of you, as it were. That image begins to be invested with psychic power. It begins to accumulate to itself, if you're able to do the practice successfully. It begins to be invested with psychic power. And if you're able to contemplate it in the context of your overall spiritual life, in your understanding of the nature of the Dharma, that image itself becomes invested with insight. That image becomes the vehicle for insight. So the image itself is illumined. Through the image shines the light of Bodhi, of awakening. The image becomes the container for insight. So in that tradition, you use imagination quite consciously and deliberately to lift yourself up to illumination. But at lower levels, the image, if it is, as it were, an uplifted image, begins to be invested with greater and greater significance. It begins to carry more and more meaning. So the image transforms itself into a symbol. It transforms itself into a symbol that carries significance, that carries meaning. And the meaning is not a conceptual meaning. So that if you try to explain what the image communicates to you, you say things like, well, I could put it like this, but this isn't really it. It's not quite this. When you do explain it, you sometimes have a feeling of betraying it. Sometimes you get this with a dream. You have a very, very strong dream, and you feel impelled to communicate it. And in the communication, you feel a sense of disappointment, even of betrayal, particularly if people too hastily start to impose a meaning on it. Jung said that the dream is its own meaning, so that meaning isn't something separate from the dream. So that the meaning is not a significance, a conceptual imposition upon the image. It's something that is completely integrated into the image. So the image contains more and more meaning. The image is transformed more and more. How are you doing? You with me? So, you know, you look at the Buddha. You look at the Buddha. And, you know, to begin with, you take in the formal elements of the Buddha image. And to some extent, that's going to depend, the effect it has upon you is going to depend upon the skill of the artist. But to some extent, it simply depends upon your own imaginative capacity. But when you look at the image, well, you begin to take in its formal elements, the colour, the shape, the posture, and so forth. But it may be that the image begins to take on some sort of significance for you. It may begin to communicate something to you. It may even seem as if the image is, as it were, speaking to you. So that it begins to communicate something more than its mere formal elements. Something of value, something of meaning is conveyed to you by the image. And so that the image is beginning to be transformed into a significant symbol which begins to live. That's the sense you get, that it begins to live. So yes, the imagination transforms its objects into symbols. Anything can be transformed in that way. And in the course of ordinary life, many things can suddenly become significant. You can suddenly find that a glass of water, you suddenly become transfixed by it. You sometimes find that if you're preoccupied, and your mind is just sort of occupied with something, and you're just staring at something, and suddenly you become aware of it there, and the image begins to speak. It begins to say something which you hadn't been expecting. Imagination is always caught out of the corner of the eye. It's not in the direct stare, as it were. It's not something you intend. It slides into the mind. It reveals itself unexpectedly, so that the image begins to transform into a symbol without your exactly intending it. This is the complication of the conscious evocation of symbols, if you see what I mean. They're almost too conscious. One of the problems is that you're looking at it very consciously and deciding you are a symbol. And the symbol, the image, stubbornly refuses to become a symbol. It just remains a mere visual image. Many of us have this problem with Buddhist visualization. It stubbornly refuses to live. Even though we may have a very strong imaginative connection with the Buddha, it won't fit into the form of the practice. I speak from bitter experience. So yes, so imagination transforms the objects of sensory experience and of non-sensory experience into significant symbols. Imagination is a unifying function. As it begins to come into operation, in the sense that I'm using it, in the sense that Sangharakshita uses it, in the sense that the Romantics used it, and the great English aesthetic tradition uses it, imagination begins to pull into itself other faculties. So imagination unites emotion. So as you become imaginatively engaged with something, you feel a very strong emotional pull. Not necessarily a pleasant one. You may be very, very strongly disturbed. But there's a strong emotional pull, a strong emotional response. There's an aesthetic response, in other words, a response of the senses, so that the senses are stimulated, stirred, often very pleasurably. There's a very strong sense of delight, although not necessarily as odd. This delight may not be a pleasurable delight, as when you, it's maybe not the best image, just ones that come immediately into my mind, but some of the Rembrandt portraits, in a way, are quite sad. The figure who is being, the person who's being conveyed, is a sort of ruin, as it were. Their face is a ruin, a deep human suffering, often etched into the face. So in a certain sense, it's not pleasant. But the communication of that, and even the mere quality of the paint on the canvas, is intensely satisfying. Maybe satisfying would be a better term than pleasurable. So there's an aesthetic, a sense of aesthetic satisfaction, even though it may be, in a sense, disturbing or even a bit saddening. The senses are satisfied. You feel that something's being fulfilled in a sensory sense. And then the cognitive sense is engaged. So the sense of meaning, the image, isn't merely emotionally charged. It's not merely aesthetically or sensorily satisfying. It's significant, and all in a single experience. You can't easily unpack them, or you have to spend time unpacking them. And you may have to, as it were, out of the experience, in an experience of those different faculties disintegrated, look back at the experience and unpack what happened, if you see what I mean. So you may have to say, well, yeah, I did feel very strongly moved. Yes, I did find it very aesthetically satisfying, and it did communicate some deeper sense of meaning, although I'm sorry to say I can't exactly say what. So in the experience itself, it all comes together. I remember it flashed into my mind just then. I was thinking to myself, I must make an example. I talk so abstractly sometimes. I remember a long, long time ago, oh my goodness, so long ago, I remember going to Italy, and in a way it was my aesthetic education. I went to Florence and with a girlfriend who knew about these things and taught me to see, Marici, who some of you know. And she taught me to see, and we went around the Uffizi and all the great galleries in Florence. And then we went to Arezzo, which is a small town nearby where Piero flourished. And I was very touched by the Piero frescoes. But what really struck me, of course, were my eyes educated by the art that I was seeing. We were walking one night, after a few glasses of wine, it has to be said, down some back streets in a rather shabby part of town. And there was a ruined building. There was just a gable end, an old, everything in that era of Italy is so beautiful. Even the ruins are just so beautiful. The stones are such a beautiful colour, and they've been put together so well. You know, Italians do everything with such style. Even their ruins have style. And this beautiful gable end, this just plain gable end, It had a window in it, just a simple square window, that no frame or anything like that. And I, just walking along, slightly tipsy, looked up and saw this gable end sort of outlined against the sky. And suddenly I was laughing. I was on the verge of tears. And I tried to explain what I was seeing. You know, and it was something to do with inside and outside being the same, because I couldn't tell which was the which, you know, I just seeing the gable wall, I couldn't see which was the inside of the building, which was the outside. And in a way, I just couldn't explain. It said something about the way life is. Even now, I'm not quite sure what I meant. But just a single image, a very beautiful image, so it's very sensorially satisfying. I was in a context of being in love and being in Italy and being tipsy, having had a beautiful spaghetti of some sort, and just in a really good mood. And suddenly something sort of really evokes a strong emotional response of a joy, of satisfaction, and a sense of meaning, that this was something very, very profound, which could not be heaved into words. That was imagination, far more than anything that had happened in looking at Botticelli, which I loved, and Fra Angelico particularly enjoyed the frescoes in San Marco, and so on. What was really far more significant, where all that came together in the perception of that that gable end, that image evoked my imagination, and it unified for a while, for a tiny while, all the faculties that usually make up me, and which are often at war with each other. Often emotion and reason are in conflict. Reason wants to go that way, emotion wants to go that way. Senses are drawing you in a particular direction, emotion goes in another, reason in another. But for a while, they all came together in the image. A very important and powerful experience, which I've forgotten about until this moment. I hadn't thought about it for a long time. Every now and again, it floats into my mind. Sometimes in meditation, it floats into my mind just to be contemplated. So that characterizes this function of imagination as the drawing together of the faculties that we in our ordinary self-identity experience as divided, as split up, even as contrary, contradictory, in conflict. In the act of imagination, in the sense that I mean it, inspiration, they are unified. It's something more than inspiration. For me, inspiration only captures the, as it were, emotional content of it. But imagination it connotes also the sensory, and the aesthetic, and the significance. So the imagination has this character. It as it operates more and more fully, it unifies you. And you will gain experiences of this kind, for instance, in meditation. When you successfully get into meditation, you feel whole. And you can sometimes experience that you know, when you come along to a class and maybe you've had a busy day, your mind is quite disintegrated, it's occupied with this, occupied with that, you're left over with some feeling from earlier in the day that you've not been able to resolve. You've got, you know, maybe a bit of a sense of sensory dissatisfaction because you've been in ugly environments or just jangled environments. Come into the shrine room, you managed to, for whatever reason, get yourself together. And it's that's the feeling, getting yourself together, integrating yourself, so that for a while you feel whole. And it may not go very deep, it may not go very profound. It may be just like at the beginning of this session, you just sat there, whew, and everything sort of settles down, everything comes together, you feel whole, you feel present, you've got nothing left over, you're not waiting for anything, you're just here, you know what's going on, and you feel a bit of satisfaction, and a bit of sense of, life is worthwhile. And of course that goes much deeper if you really successfully engage in meditation. That sense of wholeness can become very profound indeed as you explore what we call dhyana, which are really, from this point of view, very deep states of imaginative integration. You can become very, very intensely whole, very, very intensely unified, and sense yourself as quite different. Sometimes you can get the experience of this sort of imaginative unification, especially in meditation, but in other contexts too. For instance, in the context of nature, if you go out into nature, you can have a very strong sense of unification, of coming to yourself, coming to your senses, in the phrase of a recent very, very interesting book on phenomenology. You come to your senses in the sense that you are simply unified in what you are experiencing. Or an aesthetic experience, looking at a painting, listening to a poem, or seeing a piece of music, you have a sense of yourself unified, and often what you feel is, I've forgotten about this, because most of the time we experience ourselves in a much more disintegrated way. But for a while you experience yourself unified, and it's very satisfying, very wholesome. Unfortunately, once you're out of it, you often can't connect with it, you forget about it. So, a little bit more, and then I've got to conclude. Imagination is dynamic. So, it has within it a transcending tendency. If you do engage imaginatively, if you get this experience of unification, it has a natural tendency to go deeper. Once you actually engage with the image, once you engage imaginatively, there's a momentum that carries you forward. I'll just note that for the time being. I won't try and evoke that much more. My final point is, of course, the $64,000 question. And I won't go into it. It's the ontology of imagination, but we'll start with that tomorrow. Is what you are experiencing imaginary in the everyday sense? Is it just a fantasy, or is it real and true? But we'll come to that tomorrow. So for the time being, we've looked at, I hope you've got beginning to get some evocation of what I mean. We've looked at imagination as not just to do with visionary faculty. It's a faculty that we all have, but that we do not generally recognize or value, and that we need to educate by exercising, if you see what I mean. It's not something we add to ourselves, something we discover in ourselves and then explore through allowing it to function. It's more than individual. It strikes at something more than our ordinary selves. We have a sense of something bigger than us at play. It transforms into a symbol. It transforms our experience so that it becomes significant. It unifies our experience so that our reason, emotion, our sensory functioning, our unconscious, our conscious, all begin to be accumulated in the image, whether that's a visual kind or any other. And it's dynamic. It tends to move. So tomorrow and the next day, I'll explore that, and I hope get more clear about what it means. First of all, in relation to the world around us, the natural world. Our ancestors explored or saw, and not just our ancestors, probably three quarters of humanity today see the world around them as animate, as full of living beings, not of an ordinary flesh and blood kind. They see spirits, they see gods, they see goddesses, or they think of, they know, they feel the presence of these. Generally, we don't. So what has this got to do with the imagination? Is it of any significance to us? Then we're going to look at it in terms of imagination within aesthetic experience, cultural experience, and even within the field of the arts. Then finally, probably the day after tomorrow, we'll look at it functioning within the field of a conscious spiritual path, within the field of meditation, and within the field of mindfulness, and within the field of insight. So we'll be looking at this faculty operating in our ordinary experience of the world around us. How does imagination play out in our everyday experience? How does imagination play out in our aesthetic experience? How does imagination play out in our meditative and our dharmic experience? So I hope you've got some idea of what I'm talking about, even if everything is not clear. Don't worry, it'll hopefully not exactly become clear in a conceptual sense, but you'll get more and more an idea of what I'm talking about, I hope. Okay? We've got to stop because people are coming. So see you, if you want to come, at 5:30 tomorrow.